Okay, I know what it is, Kelly said. He leaned over her Plymouth Satellite, jacket and tie off, sleeves rolled up. His hands were already dirty from half an hour's probing. Just like that? Sandy got out of her car, taking the keys with her, which seemed odd on reflection, since the damned car wouldn't start. Why not leave them in and let some car thief go nuts, she wondered. I got it down to one thing. It's the solenoid switch. What's that, she asked, standing next to Kelly and looking at the oily blue mystery that was an automobile engine. The little switch you put the key in isn't big enough for all the juice you need to turn the starter. So that switch controls a bigger one here. Kelly pointed with a wrench. It activates an electromagnet that closes a bigger switch, and that one lets the electricity go to the starter motor. Follow me so far?
I think so.
Which was almost true. They told me I needed a new battery. I suppose somebody told you that mechanics love to jerk women around because we're so dumb with cars, Sandy noted with a grimace. Something like that. You're going to have to pay me something, though, Kelly told her, rummaging in his toolbox.
What's that?
I'm going to be too dirty to take you out to dinner. We have to eat here, he said, disappearing under the car, white shirt, worsted slacks and all. A minute later, he was back out, his hands dirty. Try it now. Sandy got back in and turned the key. The battery was down a little, but the engine caught almost at once. Leave it on to charge things up.
What was it?
Loose wire. All I did was tighten it up some. Kelly looked at his clothes and grimaced. So did Sandy. You need to take it into the shop and have a lock washer put on the nut. Then it shouldn't get loose again.
You didn't have to.
You have to get to work tomorrow, right? Kelly asked reasonably.
Where can I wash up?
Sandy led him into the house and pointed him towards a bathroom. Kelly got the grime off his hands before rejoining her in the living room.
Where'd you learn to fix cars? She asked, handing him a glass of wine.
My dad was a shade tree mechanic. He was a fireman, remember? He had to learn all that stuff, and he liked it. I learned from him.
Thanks.
Kelly toasted her with the glass. He wasn't a wine drinker, but it wasn't bad.
Was?
He died while I was in Vietnam, heart attack on the job. Mom's gone, too, liver cancer, when I was in grade school, Kelly explained as evenly as he could. The pain was distant now.
That was tough.
Dad and I were pretty close. He was a smoker, that's probably what killed him. I was sick myself at the time, infection from a job I did. I couldn't get home or anything, so I just stayed over there when I got better.
I wondered why nobody came to visit you, but I didn't ask, Sandy said, realizing how alone John Kelly was.
I have a couple uncles and some cousins, but we don't see each other much. It was a little clearer now, Sandy thought. Losing his mother at a young age, and in a particularly cruel and lingering way. He'd probably always been a big kid, tough and proud, but helpless to change things. Every woman in his life had been taken away by force of one kind or another. His mother, his wife, and his lover.
How much rage he must feel, she told herself. It explained so much.
When he'd seen Kofan threatening her, it was something he could protect her from. She still thought she could have handled it herself, but now she understood a little better. It diffused her lingering anger, as did his manner. He didn't get too close to her, didn't undress her with his eyes. Sandy particularly hated that, though strangely she allowed patience to do it because she felt that it helped to perk them up. He acted like a friend, she realized, as one of Tim's fellow officers might have done, mixing familiarity with respect for her identity, seeing her as a person first, a woman after that. Sandra Manning O'Toole found herself liking it. As big and tough as he was, there was nothing to fear from this man. It seemed an odd observation with which to begin a relationship, if that was the thing happening. Another thunk announced the arrival of the evening paper. Kelly got it and scanned the front page before dropping it on the coffee table. A front-page story on this slow summer news day was the discovery of another dead drug pusher. She saw Kelly looking at it,
scanning the first couple of paragraphs. Henry's increasing control of the local drug traffic virtually ensured that the newly dead dealer had been one of his distant minions. He'd known the dead man by his street name and only learned the real one, Lionel Hall, from the news article. They'd never actually met, but Bandana had been mentioned to him as a clever chap, one worth keeping his eye on. Not clever enough, Tucker thought. The ladder to success in his business was steep, with slippery rungs, the selection process brutally Darwinian, and somehow Lionel Hall had not been equal to the demands of his new profession. A pity, but not a matter of great import. Henry rose from his chair and stretched. He'd slept late. Having taken delivery 2 days earlier of fully 15 kilograms of material, as he was starting to call it. The boat trip to and from the packaging point had taken its toll. It was becoming a pain in the ass, Tucker thought, maintaining that elaborate cover. Those thoughts were dangerous, however, and he knew it. This time he'd merely watched his people do the work. And now two more knew more than they'd known before. But he was tired of doing such menial work himself. He had minions for that. Little people who knew that they were little, and knew they would prosper only so long as they followed orders exactly. Women were better at that than men. Men had egos that they had to nurture within their own fertile minds, and the smaller the mind, the greater the ego. Sooner or later, one of his people would rebel, get a little too uppity. The hookers he used were so much more easily cowed, and then there was the fringe benefit of having them around. Tucker smiled. Doris awoke about 5, her head pounding with a barbiturate-induced hangover made worse still by the double shot of whiskey that someone had decided to give her. The pain told her that she would have to live another day, that the mixture of drugs and alcohol hadn't done the job she'd dared to hope for when she'd looked at the glass, hesitated, then gunned it down before the party. What had followed the whiskey and the drugs was only half remembered, and it blended into so many other such nights that she had trouble separating the new from the old. They were more careful now. Pam had taught them that. She sat up, looking at the handcuff on her ankle, its other end locked in a chain that was in turn fastened to a fitting screwed into the wall. Had she thought about it, she might have tried ripping it out, which a healthy young woman might have accomplished with a few hours of determined effort. But escape was death, a particularly hard and lengthy death, and as much as she desired the escape from a life grown horrid beyond any nightmare, pain still frightened her. She stood, causing the chain to rattle. After a moment or two, Rick came in. "Hey, baby," the young man said with a smile that conveyed amusement rather than affection. He bent down, unlocked the cuffs, and pointed to the bathroom. "Shower. You need it." "Where did you learn to cook Chinese?" Kelly asked.
"A nurse I worked with last year, Nancy Wu. She's teaching at the University of Virginia now. You like it?"
"You kidding me?"
If the shortest distance to any man's heart is his stomach, then one of the better compliments a man can give a woman is to ask for seconds. He held himself to one glass of wine, but attacked the food as quickly as decent table manners allowed.
"It's not that good," Sandy said, blatantly fishing for a compliment.
"It's much better than what I fix for myself, but if you're thinking about writing a cookbook, you need somebody with better taste." He looked up. "I visited Taipei for a week once, and this is almost that good."
"What did you do there?"
"R&R, sort of a vacation from getting shot at." Kelly stopped it there. Not everything he and his friends had done was proper information to convey to a lady. Then he saw that he'd gone too far already.
"That's what Tim said. I already had it planned for us to meet in Hawaii, but..."
Her voice stopped again. Kelly wanted to reach out to her, take her hand across the table, just to comfort her, but he feared it might seem to be an advance.
"I know, Sandy."
"So what else did you learn to cook?"
"Quite a lot. Nancy stayed with me for a few months and made me do all the cooking. She's a wonderful teacher.
I believe it. Kelly cleaned his plate. What's your schedule like?
I usually get up 5:15, leave here just after 6. I like to be on the unit 30 minutes before shift change, so I can check the status of the patients and get ready for the new arrivals from the OR. It's a busy unit. What about you?
Well, it depends on the job. When I'm shooting...
Shooting?
Sandy asked, surprised. Explosives. It's my specialty. You spend a lot of time planning it and setting it up. Usually there's a few engineers around to fuss and worry and tell me what not to do. They keep forgetting that it's a hell of a lot easier to blow something up than it is to build it. I do have one trademark, though.
What's that?
On my underwater work, I shoot some blasting caps a few minutes before I do the real shoot. Kelly chuckled. To scare the fish away. She was puzzled for a second.
Oh, so they won't get hurt?
Right, it's a personal quirk. It was just one more thing. He'd killed people in war, threatened a surgeon with permanent injury right in front of her and a security guard, but he went out of his way to protect fish?
You're a strange one.
He had the good grace to nod. I don't kill for the fun of it. I used to hunt, and I gave that up. I fish a little, but not with dynamite. Anyway, I set the caps a good ways from the real job. That's so it won't have any effect on the important part. The noise scares most of them away. Why waste a perfectly good game fish? Kelly asked. It was automatic. Doris was somewhat nearsighted, and the marks looked like dirt when her eyes were clouded by the falling water. But they weren't dirt, and they didn't wash off. They never disappeared, merely migrating to different places at the vagaries of the men who inflicted them. She rubbed her hands over them, and the pain told her what they were, reminders of the more recent parties, and then the effort to wash herself became futile. She knew she'd never be clean again. The shower was only good for the smell, wasn't it? Even Rick had made that clear enough, and he was the nicest of them, Doris told herself, finding a fading brown mark that he had placed on her, not one so painful as the bruises that Billy seemed to like. She stepped out to dry off. The shower was the only part of the room that was even vaguely tidy. Nobody ever bothered to clean the sink or toilet, and the mirror was cracked. Much better, Rick said, watching. His hand extended to give her a pill.
Thanks.
And so began another day, with a barbiturate to put distance between herself and reality, to make life, if not comfortable, not tolerable, then endurable, barely. With a little help from her friends, who saw to it that she did endure the reality they made. Doris swallowed the pill with a handful of water, hoping that the effects would come fast. It made things easier, smoothing the sharp edges, putting a distance between herself and herself. It had once been a distance too great to see across, but no longer. She looked at Rick's smiling face as it swept over her. "You know I love you, baby," he said, reaching to fondle her. A wan smile as she felt his hands.
"Yes."
"Special party tonight, Dor. Henry's coming over." Click. Kelly could almost hear the sound as he got out of the Volkswagen, 4 blocks from the corner brownstone, as he switched trains of thought. Entering the tree line was becoming routine. He'd established a comfort level that tonight's dinner had enhanced, his first with another human being in 5 weeks, 6. He returned to the matter at hand. He settled into a spot on the other side of the cross street, again finding marble steps which generated a shadow, and waited for the roadrunner to arrive. Every few minutes he'd lift the wine bottle. He had a new one now, with a red street wine instead of the white, for a simulated drink, while his eyes continuously swept left and right, even up and down to check second and third floor windows. Some of the other cars were more familiar now. He spotted the black Carmen Ghia, which had played its part in Pam's death. The driver, he saw, was someone of his age, with a mustache,
prowling the street looking for his connection. He wondered what the man's problem was that, to assuage it, he had to come from wherever his home life might be to this place, risking his physical safety so that he might shorten his life with drugs. He was also leaving corruption and destruction in his wake with the money from the illicit traffic. Didn't he care about that? Didn't he see what drug money did to these neighborhoods? But that was something Kelly was working very hard to ignore as well. There were still real people trying to eke out their lives here. Whether on welfare or subsisting on menial employment, real people lived here, in constant danger, perhaps hoping to escape to some place where a real life was possible. They ignored the traffickers as best they could, and in their petty righteousness they ignored the street bums like Kelly. But he could not find it in himself to dislike them for that. In such an environment, they, like he, had to concentrate on personal survival. Social conscience was a luxury that most people here could scarcely afford. You needed some rudimentary personal security of your own before you could take from its surplus and apply it to those more needy than yourself. And besides, how many were more needy than they were? There were times when it was just a pleasure to be a man, Henry thought in the bathroom. Doris had her charms. Maria, the spindly, dumb one from Florida. Xantha, the one most drug-dependent, a cause for minor concern. And Roberta and Paula. None were much beyond 20, two still in their teens. All the same and all different. He patted some aftershave onto his face. He ought to have a real main lady of his own, someone glamorous for other men to see and envy. But that was dangerous. To do that invited notice. No, this was just fine. He walked out of the room, refreshed and relaxed. Doris was still there, semi-conscious now from the experience and the two-pill reward, looking at him with a smile that he decided was respectful enough. She'd made the proper noises at the proper times, done the things that he'd wanted done without being asked. He could mix his own drinks after all, and the silence of solitude was one thing, while the silence of a dumb bitch in the house was something else, something tedious. Just to be pleasant, he bent down, offering a finger to her lips, which she duly kissed, her eyes unfocused. "Let her sleep it off," Henry told Billy on the way out. "Right. I have a pickup tonight anyway," Billy reminded him. "Oh?" Tucker had forgotten in the heat of the moment. Even Tucker was human. "Little man was short 1,000 last night. I let it slide. It's the first time, and he said he just goofed on his count. The vig is an extra 5 yards. His idea." Tucker nodded. It was the first time ever that little man had made that kind of mistake. And he had always shown proper respect, running a nice trade on his piece of sidewalk. "Make sure he knows that one mistake's the house limit." "Yes, sir," Billy bobbed his head, showing proper respect himself. "Don't let that word get out, either." That was the problem. Actually, several problems, Tucker thought. First, the street dealers were such small-timers, stupidly greedy, unable to see that a regular approach to their business made for stability. And stability was in everyone's interest. But street pushers were street pushers, criminals after all, and he'd never change that. Every so often one would die from a rip or a turf fight. Some were even dumb enough to use their own stuff. Henry was as careful as he could be to avoid them, and had been mainly successful. Occasionally one would try to press the limits, claiming to be cash short, just to chisel a few $100, when he had a street trade many times that. Such cases had a single remedy, and Henry had enforced that rule with sufficient frequency and brutality that it hadn't been necessary to repeat it for a long time. Little man had probably spoken the truth. His willingness to pay the large penalty made it likely, also evidence of the fact that he valued his steady supply, which had grown in recent months as his trade increased. Still, for months to come, he would have to be watched carefully.
What most annoyed Tucker was that he had to trouble himself with such trivialities as Little Man's accounting mistake. He knew it was just a case of growing pains, the natural transition process from small-time local supplier to major distributor. He'd have to learn to delegate his authority, letting Billy, for example, handle a higher level of responsibility. Was he ready? Good question, Henry told himself, leaving the building. He handed a 10 to the youth who'd watched over his car, still considering the question. Billy had a good instinct for keeping the girls in line. A clever white boy from Kentucky's coal country, no criminal record. Ambitious. Team player. Maybe he was ready for a step up. Finally, Kelly thought to himself. It was 2:15 when the Roadrunner appeared, after at least an hour's worrying that it might not appear at all. He settled back in the shadows, becoming a little more erect, and turned his head to give the man a good look. Billy and his sidekick, laughing about something. The other one stumbled on the steps, maybe having had a drink too many or something. More to the point, when he fell, there was a flutter of light, little twirling rectangles that had to be banknotes. That's where they count their money, Kelly wondered. How interesting. Both men bent down quickly to recover the cash, and Billy cuffed the other man on the shoulder, half playfully, saying something that Kelly couldn't make out from 50 yards off. The buses passed every 45 minutes at this time of night, and their route was several blocks away. The police patrol was highly predictable. The neighborhood routine was predictable as well. By 8, the regular traffic was gone, and by 9:30 the local citizens abandoned the streets entirely, barricading themselves behind triple-locked doors, thanking Providence that they had survived another day, already dreading the dangers of the next, and leaving the streets mainly to the illicit traffic. That traffic lingered until about 2, Kelly had long since established, and on careful consideration, he decided that he knew all that he needed to know. There were still random elements to be considered. There always were, but you could not predict the random, only prepare for it. Alternate evasion routes, constant vigilance, and weapons were the defense against it. Something was always left to chance, and however uncomfortable that was, Kelly had to accept it as a part of normal life. Not that anything about his mission was normal. He rose, tiredly, crossing the street and heading to the brownstone with his accustomed drunken gait. The door, he confirmed, wasn't locked. The brass plate behind the knob was askew, he saw as he took a single long look while he passed by. The image fixed itself in his mind, and as he moved he began planning his mission for the following night. He heard Billy's voice again, a laugh filtering through the upstairs windows, an oddly accented sound, decidedly unmusical. A voice he already loathed, and for which he had special plans. For the first time he was close to one of the men who had murdered Pam. Probably 2 of them. It didn't have the physical effect one might have expected. His body relaxed. He'd do this one right. "Be seeing you guys," he promised in the silence of his thoughts. This was the next really big step forward, and he couldn't risk blowing it. Kelly headed up the block, his eyes fixed on the 2 bobs 1/4 mile away, clearly visible due to their size and the perfectly straight, wide city street. This was another test. He had to be sure of himself. He headed north, without crossing the street, because if he followed a straight path all the way to them, they might notice and be at least curious about it, if not really alert. His approach had to be invisible, and by changing his angle relative to his targets instead of holding constant, he allowed his stooped body to blend into the background of house fronts and parked cars. Just ahead, a small dark shape, nothing dangerous. At 1 block's distance he crossed the street, taking the opportunity again to scan all 4 compass points. Turning left, he headed up the sidewalk. It was fully 12 or 15 feet wide, punctuated by the marble steps. giving useful maneuvering room for his uneven, meandering walk. Kelly stopped, lifting the bag-wrapped bottle to his lips before moving on. Better yet, he thought, another demonstration of his harmless nature. He stopped again to urinate in the gutter.
"Shit!"
a voice said, big or little. He didn't bother to check. The disgust in the word was enough, the sort of thing that made a man turn away from what he beheld. Besides, Kelly thought, he'd needed the relief. Both men were larger than he. Big Bob, the dealer, was 6'3". Little Bob, the lieutenant, was fully 6'5", muscular, but already developing a pot from beer or starchy food. Both were quite formidable enough, Kelly decided, making a quick reevaluation of his tactics. Better to pass by and leave them be? No. But he did pass by first. Little Bob was looking across the street. Big Bob was leaning back against the building. Kelly drew an imaginary line between the two and counted three steps before turning left slowly so as not to alert them. He moved his right hand under the new old bush jacket as he did so. As the right came out, the left covered it, wrapping around the handle of the Colt automatic in a two-hand grip and boxing posture, later to be called the Weaver stance. His eyes went down, acquiring the white-painted line on the top of the suppressor as the gun came up. His arms extended full length without locking the elbows, and the physical maneuver brought the sights in alignment with the first target, quickly but smoothly. The human eye is drawn to motion, particularly at night. Big Bob saw the move, knowing that something untoward was happening, but not sure what. His street-smart instincts made the correct analysis and screamed for action. Too late. "Gun," he saw, starting to move his hand to a weapon of his own instead of dodging, which might have delayed his death. Kelly's fingertip depressed the trigger twice, the first as the suppressor covered the target, the second right behind it, as soon as his wrist compensated for the .22's light recoil. Without shifting his feet, he swiveled right, a mechanical turn that took the gun in an exact horizontal plane towards Little Bob, who had reacted already, seeing his boss starting to fall and reaching for his own weapon at his hip. Moving, but not fast enough. Kelly's first shot was not a good one, hitting low and doing little damage. But the second entered the temple, caroming off the thicker portions of the skull and racing around inside like a hamster in a cage. Little Bob fell on his face. Kelly lingered only long enough to be sure that both were dead, then turned and moved on. 6, he thought, heading for the corner, his heart settling down from the rush of adrenaline, putting the gun back in its place next to the knife. It was 2:56 as Kelly began his evasion drill. Things hadn't started off well, the recon marine thought. The chartered bus had broken down once, and the shortcut the driver had selected to make up lost time had come to a halt behind a traffic tie-up. The bus pulled into Quantico Marine Base just after 3, following a jeep to its final destination. The Marines found an isolated barracks building already half-occupied by snoring men and picked bunks for themselves so they could get some sleep. Whatever the interesting, exciting, dangerous mission was to be, the startup was just one more day in the green machine. Her name was Virginia Charles, and her night wasn't going well either. A nurse's aide at St. Agnes Hospital, only a few miles out from her neighborhood, her shift had been extended by the late arrival of her relief worker and her own unwillingness to leave her part of the floor unattended. Though she'd worked the same shift at the hospital for 8 years, she hadn't known that the bus schedule changed soon after her normal departure time, and having just missed one bus, she'd have to wait what seemed to be forever for the next. Now she was getting off, 2 hours past her normal bedtime and having missed the Tonight Show, which she watched religiously on weekdays. 40, divorced from a man who had given her 2 children, one a soldier, thankfully in Germany, not Vietnam, and the other still in high school, and little else. On her union job, which was somewhere between menial and professional, she'd managed to do well for both of her sons, ever worrying, as mothers do, about their companions and their chances. She was tired when she got off the bus, asking herself again why she hadn't used some of the money she'd saved over the years to get herself a car. But a car demanded insurance, and she had a young son at home who would both increase the cost of driving and give her something else to worry about. Maybe in a few years, when that one too entered the service, which was his only hope for the college education she wished for him, but would never be able to afford on her own. She walked quickly and alertly, a tense stiffness in her weary legs. How the neighborhood had changed. She'd lived within a three-block radius all her life, and she could remember a lively and safe street life with friendly neighbors. She could even remember being able to walk to the New Zion AME church without a worry, even on a rare Wednesday night off, which she had missed again due to her job. But she consoled herself with 2 hours of overtime, which she could bank, and watched the streets for danger. It was only 3 blocks, she told herself. She walked fast, smoking a cigarette to stay alert, telling herself to stay calm. She'd been mugged. The local term was actually yoked, twice in the previous year, both times by drug addicts needing money to support whatever habits they had. And the only good thing to come from that was the object lesson it had given to her sons. Nor had it cost her much in monetary terms. Virginia Charles never carried much more money than carfare and other change to get dinner at the hospital cafeteria. It was the assault on her dignity that hurt, but not quite as badly as her memories of better times in a neighborhood peopled by mostly law-abiding citizens. One more block to go, she told herself, turning a corner.
"Hey, Mama, spare a dollar," a voice said, already behind her.
She'd seen the shadow and kept walking past it, not turning, not noticing, ignoring it in the hope that the same courtesy would be extended to her. But that sort of courtesy was becoming rare. She kept moving, lowering her head, telling herself to keep moving, that not too many street toughs would attack a woman from behind. A hand on her shoulder gave the lie to that assumption.
"Give me money, bitch," the voice said next,
not even with anger. Just a matter-of-fact command in an even tone that defined what the new rules of the street were.
"Ain't got enough to interest you, boy," Virginia Charles said, twisting her shoulders so that she could keep moving, still not looking back, for there was safety in movement.
Then she heard a click.
"I'll cut you," the voice said, still calm, explaining the hard facts of life to the dumb bitch.
That sound frightened her. She stopped, whispering a quiet prayer, and opened her small purse. She turned slowly, still more angry than frightened. She might have screamed, and only a few years earlier it would have made a difference. Men would have heard it and looked, perhaps come out to chase the assailant away. She could see him now, just a boy, 17 or 18, and his eyes had the lifeless amplification of some sort of drug, that plus the arrogant inhumanity of power. Okay, she thought. Pay him off and go home. She reached into the purse and extracted a $5 bill.
$5 whole?
The youth smirked. I need more than that, bitch. Come on, or I'll cut you. It was the look in the eyes that really scared her, causing her to lose her composure for the first time, insisting,
"It's all I have."
"More, or you bleed." Kelly turned the corner, only half a block from his car, just starting to relax. He hadn't heard anything until he made the turn, but there were 2 people, not 20 feet from the rusting Volkswagen, and a flare of reflected light told him that one was holding a knife. His first thought was, shit. He'd already decided about this sort of thing. He couldn't save the whole world, and he wasn't going to try. Stopping one street crime might be fine for a TV show, but he was after bigger game. What he had not considered was an incident right next to his car. He stopped cold, looking, and his brain started grinding as quickly as the renewed flood of adrenaline allowed. If anything serious happened here, the police would come right to this place, might be here for hours, and he'd left a couple of dead bodies less than a quarter mile behind him.
Not even that far, because it wasn't a straight line. This was not good, and he didn't have much time to make a decision. The boy had the woman by the arm, brandishing a knife, with his back to him. 20 feet was an easy shot, even in the dark, but not with a 22 that penetrated too much, and not with someone innocent, or at least non-threatening, behind him. She was wearing some sort of uniform, older, maybe 40, Kelly saw, starting to move that way. That's when things changed again. The boy cut the woman's upper arm, the red clear in the glow of the streetlights. Virginia Charles gasped when the knife sliced her arm, and yanked away, or tried to, dropping the $5 bill. The boy's other hand grabbed her throat to control her, and she could see in his eyes that he was deciding the next place for the knife to go. Then she saw movement, a man perhaps 15 feet away, and in her pain and panic, she tried to call for help. It wasn't much of a sound, but enough for the mugger to notice. Her eyes were fixed on something. What? The youth turned to see a street wino 10 feet away. What had been an instant and automatic alarm changed to a lazy smile. Shit. This was not going well at all. Kelly's head was lowered, his eyes up and looking at the boy, sensing that the event was not really in his control. "Maybe you got some money too, Pop," he asked, intoxicated with power. And on a whim, he took a step towards the man who had to have more money than this nursey bitch. Kelly hadn't expected it, and it threw his timing off. He reached for his gun, but the silencer caught on his waistband, and the incoming mugger instinctively took his movement for the threatening act it had to be. He took another step, more quickly, extending his knife hand. There was no time now to bring the gun out. Kelly stopped, backing off a half step and coming up to an erect stance. For all his aggressiveness, the mugger wasn't very skillful. His first lunge with the knife was clumsy, and he was surprised at how easily the wino batted it aside, then stepped inside its arc. A stiff, straight right to the solar plexus deflated his lungs, winding him but not stopping his movements entirely. The knife hand came back wildly as the mugger started folding up. Kelly grabbed the hand, twisting and extending the arm, then stepping over the body already headed to the pavement. An extended, ripping, cracking sound announced the dislocation of the youth's shoulder, and Kelly continued the move, rendering the arm useless. "Why don't you go home, ma'am?" he told Virginia Charles quietly, turning his face away and hoping she hadn't seen it very well. She ought not to have done so, Kelly told himself. He'd moved with lightning speed. The nurse's aide stooped down to recover the $5 bill from the sidewalk and left without a word. Kelly watched sideways, seeing her hold her right hand on the bleeding left arm as she tried not to stagger, probably in shock. He was grateful that she didn't need any help. She would call someone, sure as hell, at least an ambulance, and he really ought to have helped her deal with her wound. But the risks were piling up faster than his ability to deal with them. The would-be mugger was starting to moan now, the pain from his destroyed shoulder penetrating the protective fog of narcotics. And this one had definitely seen his face close up. Shit, Kelly told himself. Well, he'd attempted to hurt a woman, and he'd attacked Kelly with a knife, both of them arguably failed attempts at murder. Surely this wasn't his first such attempt. He'd picked the wrong game, and tonight the wrong playground. And mistakes like that had a price. Kelly took the knife from his limp hand and shoved it hard into the base of his skull, leaving it there. Within a minute, his Volkswagen was half a block away. 7, he told himself, turning east. Shit. Chapter 19. Quantity of Mercy. It was becoming more routine than the morning coffee and Danish at his desk, Lieutenant Ryan told himself. 2 pushers down, both with a pair of 22s in the head. But not robbed this time. No loose cartridge cases around, no evident sign of a struggle. 1 with his hand on his pistol grip, but the gun hadn't cleared his hip pocket. For all that, it was unusual. He'd at least seen danger and reacted to it, however ineffectively. Then had come the call from only a few blocks away, and he and Douglas had rolled to that one, leaving junior detectives to deal with this crime scene. The call had identified the new one as interesting. "Whoa," Douglas said, getting out first. One did not often see a knife sticking in the back of a head, up in the air like a fence post. They weren't kidding. The average murder in this part of the city, or any part of any city for that matter, was some sort of domestic argument. People killed other family members or close friends over the most trivial disputes. The previous Thanksgiving, a father had killed his son over a turkey leg. Ryan's personal favorite was a homicide over a crab cake, not so much a matter of amusement as hyperbole. In all such cases, the contributing factors were usually alcohol and a bleak life that transformed ordinarily petty disputes into matters of great import. "I didn't mean it," was the phrase most often heard afterwards, followed by some variation of, "Why didn't he just back off a little?" The sadness of such events was like a slow-acting acid on Ryan's soul. The sameness of those murders was the worst part of all. Human life ought not to end like variations of a single theme. It was too precious for that, a lesson learned in the Bocage country of Normandy and the snowy forests around Bastogne, when he'd been a young paratrooper in the 101st Airborne. The typical murderer claimed not to have meant it, and frequently copped to the crime immediately, as remorseful as he or she could be over the loss of a friend or loved one by his or her own hand, and so two lives were often destroyed by the crime. Those were crimes of passion and poor judgment, and that's what murder was for the most part. But not this one. "What the hell's the matter with the arm?" he asked the medical examiner. Aside from the needle tracks, the arm was twisted around so much that he realized he was looking at the wrong side of it. "The victim's shoulder appears to be dislocated." "Make that wrecked," the ME added after a second's consideration. "We have bruising around the wrist from the force of the grip. Somebody held the arm with two hands and damn near tore the arm off, like taking a branch off a tree." "Karate move?" Douglas asked. "Something like that. That sure slowed him down some. You can see the cause of death." "Lieutenant, over here," a uniformed sergeant called. "This is Virginia Charles. She lives a block over. She reported the crime." "Are you okay, Miss Charles?" Ryan asked. A fireman paramedic was checking the bandage she'd placed on her own arm, and her son, a senior at Dunbar High School, stood by her side, looking down at the murder victim without a trace of sympathy. Within 4 minutes, Ryan had a goodly quantity of information. "A bum, you say?" "Why, no, that's the bottle he dropped," she pointed. Douglas picked it up with the greatest care. "Can you describe him?" Lieutenant Ryan asked. The routine was so exactingly normal that they might have been at any Marine base from Lejeune to Okinawa. The daily dozen exercises followed by a run, everyone in step, the senior NCO calling cadence. They took particular pleasure in passing formations of new second lieutenants in the basic officers' course, or even more wimpy examples of officer wannabes doing their summer school at Quantico. 5 miles, passing the 500-yard KD range and various other teaching facilities, all of them named for dead Marines, approaching the FBI Academy, but turning back off the main road then into the woods towards their training site. The morning routine merely reminded them that they were Marines, and the length of the run made them recon Marines, for whom Olympic-class fitness was the norm. They were surprised to see a general officer waiting for them, not to mention a sandbox and a swing set. "Welcome to Quantico, Marines," Marty Young told them after they'd had a chance to cool down and been told to stand at ease. Off to the side, they saw 2 naval officers in sparkling undress whites, and a pair of civilians watching and listening. Eyes narrowed collectively, and the mission was suddenly very interesting indeed. "Just like looking at the photos," Kaz observed quietly, looking around the training site. They knew what the lecture was about. "Why the playground stuff?" "My idea," Greer said. "Ivan has satellites. The overhead schedules for the next 6 weeks are posted inside Building A. We don't know how good the cameras are, and so I'm going to assume that they're as good as ours, okay?" You show the other guy what he wants to see, or you make it easy for him to figure out. Any really harmless place has a parking lot. The drill was already determined. Every day the new arrivals would move the cars around randomly. Around 10 every day, they would take the mannequins from the cars and distribute them around the playground equipment. At 2 or 3, the cars would be moved again and the mannequins rearranged. They suspected, correctly, that the ritual would acquire a great deal of institutional humor. "And after it's all over, it becomes a real playground?" Ritter asked, then answered his own question. "Hell, why not? Nice job, James." "Thank you, Bob." "It looks small this way," Admiral Maxwell said. "The dimensions are accurate to within 3 inches. We cheated," Ritter said. "We have the Soviet manual for building places like this. Your General Young did a nice job." "No glass in the windows on Building C," Casimir noted. "Check the photos, Kaz," Greer suggested. "There's a shortage of window glass over there. That building just has shutters here and there. The callback," he pointed to Building B, "has the bars. Just wood so that they can be removed later. We've just guessed at the inside arrangements, but we've had a few people released from the other side, and we've modeled this place on the debriefs. It's not totally made up from thin air." The Marines were already looking around, having learned a little of the mission. Much of the plan they already knew, and they were thinking about how to apply their lessons of real combat operations to this perverted playground, complete with child mannequins who would watch them train with blue doll eyes. M-79 grenades to blast the guard towers. Willie Pete through the barracks windows. Gunships to hose things down after that. The wives and kids would watch the rehearsal and tell no one. The site had been carefully selected for its similarity with another place. The Marines hadn't needed to be told that. It had to be so. And a few eyes lingered on a hill half a mile from the site. You could see everything from there. After the welcoming speech, the men divided into predetermined units to draw their weapons. Instead of M16A1 rifles, they had the shorter Kar-15 carbines, shorter, handier, preferred for close work. Grenadiers had standard M79 grenade launchers, whose sights had been painted with radioactive tritium to glow in the dark, and their bandoliers were heavy with practice rounds because weapons training would start immediately. They'd start in daylight for feel and proficiency, but almost immediately their training would switch exclusively to night work, which the general had left out. It was obvious in any case. This sort of job only happened at night. The men marched to the nearest weapons firing range to familiarize themselves. Already set up were window frames, 6 of them. The grenadiers exchanged looks and fired off their first volley. One, to his shame, missed. The other 5 razzed him at once, after making sure that the white puffs from their training rounds had appeared behind the frames. All right, I just have to warm up," the corporal said defensively, then placed 5 shots through the target in 40 seconds. He was slow. It had been a mainly sleepless night. "How strong do you have to be to do that, I wonder?" Ryan asked. "Sure as hell isn't Wally Cox," the ME observed. "The knife severed the spinal cord just where it enters the medulla. Death was instantaneous." "He already had the guy crippled. The shoulder as bad as it looks?" Douglas asked, stepping aside for the photographer to finish up. "Worse, probably. We'll look at it, but I'll bet you the whole structure is destroyed. You don't repair an injury like this, not all the way. His pitching career was over even before the knife." White, 40 or older, long black hair, short, dirty. Ryan looked at his notes. "Go home, ma'am," he'd told Virginia Charles. "Ma'am." "Our victim was still alive when she walked away." Douglas came over to his lieutenant. "Then he must have taken his knife away and gave it back. Em, in the past week we've seen 4 very expert murders and 6 very dead victims. 4 different M.O.s. 2 guys tied up, robbed and executed, .22 revolver, no sign of a struggle. 1 guy with a shotgun in the guts, also robbed, no chance to defend himself. 2 last night just shot, probably a 22 again, but not robbed, not tied up, and they were alerted before they were shot. Those were all pushers. But this guy's just a street hood. Not good enough, Tom. But the lieutenant had started thinking about it. Have we ID'd this one yet? The uniformed sergeant answered. Junkie. He's got a rap sheet, 6 arrests for robbery, God knows what else. It doesn't fit, Ryan said. It doesn't fit anything. And if you're talking about a really clever guy, why let somebody see him? Why let her leave? Why talk to her? Hell, why take this guy out at all? What pattern does that fit? There was no pattern. Sure, the 2 pairs of drug dealers had been taken down with a 22, but the small bore was the most commonly used weapon on the street, and while one pair had been robbed, the other had not. Nor had the second pair been shot with the same deadly precision, though each did have 2 head wounds. The other murdered and robbed dealer had been done by a shotgun. Look, we have the murder weapon, and we have the wine bottle, and from one or both we'll get prints. Whoever this guy was, he sure as hell wasn't real careful. A wino with a sense of justice, M? Douglas prodded. Whoever took this punk down. Yeah, I know. He wasn't Wally Cox. But who and what the hell was he? Thank God for gloves, Kelly thought, looking at the bruises on his right hand. He'd let his anger get the better of him, and that wasn't smart. Looking back, reliving the incident, he realized he'd been faced with a difficult situation. If he'd let the woman get killed or seriously injured and just gotten into his car and driven off, first, he'd never really have been able to forgive himself. And second, if anyone had seen the car, he'd be a murder suspect. That extended thought evoked a snort of disgust. He was a murder suspect now. Well, somebody would be. On coming home, he'd looked in the mirror, wig and all. Whatever that woman had seen, it had not been John Kelly, not with a face shadowed by his heavy beard, smeared with dirt, under a long and filthy wig. His hunched-over posture made him appear several inches shorter than he was, and the light on the street had not been good. And she'd been even more interested in getting away than anything else. Even so, he'd somehow left his wine bottle behind. He remembered dropping it to parry the knife thrust, and then, in the heat of the moment, he'd not recovered it. Dumb, Kelly raged at himself. What would the police know? The physical description would not be a good one. He'd worn a pair of surgical gloves, and though they allowed him to bruise his hands, they hadn't torn and he hadn't bled. Most important of all, he had never touched the wine bottle with ungloved hands. Of that he was certain, because he'd decided from the beginning to be careful about it. The police would know a street bum had killed that punk, but there were lots of street bums, and he only needed one more night. It meant that he'd have to alter his operational pattern even so, and that tonight's mission was more dangerous than it ought to be. But his information on Billy was too good to pass up on, and the little bastard might be smart enough to change his own patterns. What if he used different houses to count his cash, or only used one for a few nights? If that was true, any wait beyond a day or two might invalidate his whole reconnaissance effort, forcing him to start again with a new disguise, if he could select something equally effective, which was not immediately likely. Kelly told himself that he'd killed 6 people to get this far. The 7th was a mistake and didn't count, except maybe to that lady, whoever she was. He took a deep breath. If he'd watched her get hurt worse or killed, how would he be able to look in a mirror? He had to tell himself that he'd made the best of a bad situation. Shit happens. It ran the risks up, but the only concern there was failure in the mission, not in danger to himself. It was time to set his thoughts aside. There were other responsibilities as well. Kelly lifted his phone and dialed. Greer? Clark, Kelly responded. At least that was still amusing. You're late, the Admiral told him. The call was supposed to have been before lunch, and Kelly's stomach churned a little at the rebuke. No harm done. I just got back. We're going to need you soon. It started. That's fast, Kelly thought. Damn.
Okay, sir.
I hope you're in shape. Dutch says you are, James Greer said more kindly. I think I can hold up, sir. Ever been to Quantico? No, Admiral. Bring your boat. There's a marina there, and it'll give us a place to chat. Sunday morning, 10 sharp. We'll be waiting, Mr. Clark. Aye, aye. Kelly heard the phone click off. Sunday morning. He hadn't expected that. It was going too fast, and it made his other mission all the more urgent. Since when had the government ever moved that quickly? Whatever the reason, it affected Kelly directly.
I hate it, but it's the way we work, Grishinov said.
You really are that tied to your ground radar?
Robin, there is even talk of having the missile firing done by the intercept control officer from his booth on the ground.
The disgust in his voice was manifest.
But then you're just a driver, Zacharias announced. You have to trust your pilots.
I really should have this man speak to the general staff, Grishinov told himself with no small degree of disgust. They won't listen to me. Perhaps they would listen to him. His countrymen had vast respect for the ideas and practices of Americans, even as they planned to fight and defeat them.
It is a combination of factors. The new fighter regiments will be deployed along the Chinese border, you see.
What do you mean?
You didn't know? We've fought the Chinese 3 times this year, at the Amur River and farther west.
Oh, come on. This was too incredible for the American to believe.
Your allies.
Grishinov snorted.
Allies? Friends? From the outside, yes, perhaps it looks as though all socialists are the same. My friend, we have battled with the Chinese for centuries. Don't you read history? We supported Chiang over Mao for a long time. We trained his army for him. Mao hates us. We foolishly gave him nuclear reactors, and now they have nuclear arms. And do you suppose their missiles can reach my country or yours? They have Tu-16 bombers. Badgers, you call them, yes? Can they reach America?
Zacharias knew that answer.
No, of course not. They can reach Moscow, I promise you, and they carry half-megaton nuclear bombs. And for that reason the MiG-25 regiments are on the Chinese border. Along that axis we have no strategic depth. Robin, we've had real battles with these yellow bastards, division-size engagements. Last winter we crushed their attempt to take an island that belongs to us. They struck first. They killed a battalion of border guards and mutilated the dead.
Why do that, Robin? Because of their red hair or because of their freckles? Grishinov asked bitterly, quoting verbatim a wrathful article in Red Star.
This was a very strange turn of events for the Russian. He was speaking the literal truth, and it was harder to convince Zacharias of this than any one of a number of clever lies he might have used.
We are not allies. We've even stopped shipping weapons to this country by train. The Chinese steal the consignments right off the rail carriages.
To use against you?
Against whom, then? The Indians? Tibet? Robin, these people are different from you and me. They don't see the world as we do. They're like the Hitlerites my father fought. They think they are better than other men. How you say?
Master race, the American suggested helpfully.
That is the word, yes. They believe it. We are animals to them, useful animals, yes, but they hate us. And they want what we have. They want our oil and our timber and our land.
How come I've never been briefed on this? Zacharias demanded.
Shit, the Russian answered. Is it any different in your country? When France pulled out of NATO, when they told your people to take your bases out, do you think any of us were told about it beforehand? I had a staff job then in Germany, and nobody troubled himself to tell me that anything was happening. Robin, the way you look to us is the same as how we look to you, a great colossus. But the internal politics in your country are as much a mystery to me as mine are to you. It can all be very confusing, but I tell you this, my friend. My new MiG regiment will be based between China and Moscow. I can bring a map and show you.
Zacharias leaned back against the wall, wincing again with the recurring pain from his back. It was just too much to believe.
It hurts still, Robin?
Yeah. Here, my friend. Grishinov handed over his flask, and then